3-1 Radio on 96.9 KODX. We're in your community, on the air, and in your ear. The show starts in 3-2-1.
Hey everyone, this is Shiloh Jama. I'm here with a special guest who hasn't been around as much as usual. I think that everyone's forgotten who you are. You might want to introduce yourself there.
Oh, really? I don't think they have. They're probably really happy they don't have to listen to my big mouth anymore. But anyway, yes, it's Lise Al-Hakim once again back here. I've been gone for 2 months around, trotting around the globe, doing harm reduction stuff. You know, what I do.
Yeah. I think actually of all of us, I feel like you do not have the biggest mouth.
Well, that depends on the day. Yeah, I don't know.
That's true. We all have our sassy moments.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you've actually been to a foreign nation.
That's true. It's not my first rodeo, but yeah, I went to Portugal for the for a Hep C conference, treating Hep C and active drug users. That's the whole thing about the conference. So I went out there and spent a couple of extra days looking at castles, learned a lot about all the cool things every other country's doing when it comes to treating Hep C. They're actually treating Hep C on these on mobile needle exchange vans. Like they're just giving out the medication there. And they some of the vans actually have like the whole setup in there where you can get tested. You can get like your fibro reading where they can like actually do the X-ray and like it's pretty crazy. So they got this whole thing set up. And I think Iceland said they had cured 89% of their Hep C and like the population up there because they made it so low barrier that they were able to do that. So just saying.
Well, one of the things that I thought was really interesting, and this is just, we're driving in a little, is for folks who don't know how we treat Hep C in the United States is you get a test that really tests to see if you have any antibodies. Mm-hmm. And then you go and get a test to see if you have the viral load test, and which is a little more expensive. And one of the things I thought was really interesting we were talking about earlier is they don't do the viral load test. They just, you have antibodies, we'll just treat you straight off the bat.
Yeah. Usually they'll either go for that or they'll just do the actual confirmatory test. And there's also another test that's like a dry blood spot test, but you have to actually send that out. And that's just kind of one test. So that's something that people on the East Coast have been doing. But yeah, it's interesting because, you know, it's actually so easy to just, you know, test and treat, except for since we live in a place that doesn't have socialized medicine of any kind, everybody's case is different. You know, it's like you have to jump through these hoops. How much money do you make? Do you have insurance? So trying to explain this to these people from other countries who are like, what? You know, like, why do you have that system? That's so complicated, you know? So it's I think international conferences are about going and being jealous about how easy it is for everybody else to treat people, you know, as opposed to here. So there's a lot of me being jealous. Met some really great people who were doing kind of like, you know, drug user ran work in other countries. So it was cool. It was definitely interesting to learn all about decriminalization, which they have there. But also the problems they still have with people getting shaked down because there's actually like if you get caught with more substances than you're supposed to have. And there's a list of like how much you can have on you. And I think it's like a gram of cocaine and 2 grams of heroin. It's supposed to be a 10-day supply.
Yeah.
I think anybody who knows how drugs works knows that's not really a 10-day supply, but you can have that on you. If you get caught with more, you have to go through this center where you go in and they like watch videos and then they can link you to this or that. And then at the end you can leave and be like, okay, I want to leave. And then they'll give you your substance back. So it's basically a waste of a day.
It's a re-education camp.
I guess it is weirdly kind of that.
So you're just to be clarified, you're jealous of the re-education camp?
No, I'm not. I'm jealous of their Hep C treatment. I think that was what I specifically said. So
no, I think it's really interesting when you when we really start thinking about how to cure Hep C, because I think for a long time it was this you had to do interferon. It was a 6-month process, and it was very painful. And not a lot of people wanted to get treated. And now we have a situation where, you know, it's popping a pill once a day.
Easy.
And you can go and get treated. And so, you know, I think there's a big push. And, you know, I think there are drug companies that want you to get treated before their before all their drugs go to generic. So there's there's definitely a push there.
Because what is it now? It's like $20,000, I think, for the treatment or something like that. And it's gone down from a couple times. So if you have insurance, you know, they'll pay for some of that. You know, and so it becomes complicated then because you're like, okay, I want to get treated, but it's really expensive. And not to mention a lot of the people who the providers who are treating don't know that. Well, some of them do know and don't care, but you know, they're supposed to be able to treat everyone now, regardless of like their fibrosis score, regardless of their drug usage, like all of that stuff. It doesn't matter how far down and along you are, like they're supposed to treat you. And that didn't used to be the case. They would be like, you have to have like, you know, 90 days of sobriety. You have to be like in liver failure. So it used to be very like, you know, they wouldn't treat you without all of these boxes ticked, but that's changed.
Well, and it doesn't, when you're just looking at a completely disease prevention model, it doesn't really make sense because you want the people who are most likely the potential to infect another person to be treated as fast as possible. Because if you stop the infection rates, you know, you're just constantly reducing the amount of people who have Hep C, which you're reducing the amount of people who will need liver transplants in the future. And you know, livers aren't cheap and they're not readily available.
Yeah, so you're really reducing the amount of people who are gonna die from Hep C because who's getting a liver transplant? Nobody. I mean, let's be real. Like, I mean, you know, unless you're in some terrible accident, and you know, those are the people who are going to be usually getting them first. I mean,
well, a mutual friend of ours who did get a liver transplant. That's true. And he has to take meds every single day.
And there was a long time where it wasn't like quite sitting right.
Yeah. And so he's, you know, if we had the ability or to treat him for Hep C all those years ago, we wouldn't be in this situation. Sure. And you think about this, he's on state state health care. Mm-hmm. And so the state's paying for all of those antiviral rejection drugs and you know, and so just the cost effectiveness of treating people with hepatitis C is, you know, I think going to be really important. And we do have an aging population. Baby boomers have a lot of folks who have hepatitis C from transfusions.
And have had it for a long time too.
Yeah, and, you know, and especially from the Korean War. Vets of the Korean War have a large population of hepatitis C. And so, you know, I think this is not just something that affects drug users.
Oh, absolutely not. You know, but I think that the treatment is the main thing, and why I think there's a movement out there about it is because people still right now, even though it's not a requirement, will still require people to be in sobriety for a certain amount of time to get treatment. And that's not even, they're not supposed to even be doing that. Well, so, I mean, I think it's that call to be like, stop being bigoted in your treatment and just, you know, do no harm and treat people who need treated. You know?
I also think of these as great opportunities. You know, if someone tested positive for hepatitis C, I think, you know, 10 years ago, it was like this very serious, you have hepatitis C, you could theoretically die from this. You know, this could be a long negative thing. But I also feel like, you know, as at least if you live in King County, this can be a very positive thing. You've been tested positive. You now have an opportunity that if you chose to, and you want to be in a more kind of stable place, you could jump on Suboxone, even if you just take that during the time that you were going through treatment. And you could be gaining all this access. Then you could probably be getting some case management to try to get some housing. So being tested positive could end up being the best thing that happened to you.
Yeah.
And so I think we need to start really thinking of it this way. And that's why it's really important to treat drug users. And I think it's really important, you know, like I've said before, is to really be an anti-stigma situation and view some of these situations as opportunities
Sure.
Because people can make great positive leaps in their lives by taking their health care in their own hands. Because if you're in charge of your health care and you're getting treated and these are things that you want, you can be doing things that are in your best interest because you have much more control over it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. An opportunity to take control of your life. I don't know.
But it is. I mean,
what's the tagline on the side of the bus? Yeah. That's what I want to know.
I do feel like, I think a lot of times we talk down to folks that are economically less fortunate than we are. And sure. We have a situation where we can be incredibly very bigoted in our society towards folks. And by giving them the opportunity to put their own health care in their own hands, I find that people make the more responsible choices and what's right for them. Because maybe, I've talked to people who've tested positive for Hep C and they said they don't want to be treated right now because right now they feel like they're in a chaotic place and they want to be in a little more stable place because they want to succeed in this treatment. And I still think those are incredibly valuable decisions.
Well, because they're their decisions. Yeah. I mean, that's true. Nobody's would ever be trying to force somebody like, no, you have to get, cured. I mean, just like anything, you should do it if you want to do it. If you don't feel like you're in a spot where you want to do it right now, then okay, you can revisit that when you feel like it. But it's just that if people want it and they can't get it because of all of these little hoops that aren't even supposed to exist anymore, then that's a problem. That's all I'm saying. So,
yeah. So what do you think is the biggest barrier today in getting Hep C treated in, in Washington State?
I think the biggest barriers are the providers who won't treat people for Hep C. They still go by these old ways. They go by fibrosis score. They especially won't treat people who are in active use of anything, whether that's, from drinking to, cocaine to whatever. I mean, they won't treat anybody who has anything like that in their system, and that's not the message. And it's not the guidance we're getting from Washington State. They're saying treat everybody. So I think that the biggest barrier is finding somebody to treat active users. And I think the second biggest barrier is the biggest barrier to healthcare in general, especially for folks who are experiencing homelessness or like folks who are in poverty or folks who are, using drugs. Like, they don't want to go to the hospital. They get treated badly. So I think that's a huge barrier as well. Like, nobody wants to go in and try to go through this lengthy process in a hospital where they're going to be treated badly all the time. So I think it's those two things.
Which is, for me, really ironic because I feel like doctors with, do no harm.
Well, yeah, that's right? The whole thing, do no harm. Like, that's the ironic.
And I feel like, the medical, to be perfectly honest, the opiate crisis was caused by the medical industry and the pharmaceutical industry. And so, you talk about do no harm and we're,
do no harm and fix the thing that you screwed up.
I think the biggest issue when they started telling doctors they couldn't prescribe was instead of saying, I can give you Suboxone or I can give you these treatment options mm-hmm. to doing it, it was don't come back. We're going to put you on a list so no other doctor will treat you. When I feel like, again, these are all these opportunities, if someone came and was, you felt were drug seeking and was in pain management, you could say, hey, I could get you on Suboxone today.
Yeah. Right? I mean, I met a doctor that, he was asked cause he's a low barrier Suboxone provider now. And he was asked why he did that. Cause he had switched over from actual pain management years and years ago. They were like, well, why did you choose to do this? And he was like, because I basically created the problem. And he's like, and my Jewish guilt was like, you now have to go and fix it. So he's like, I immediately crossed the bridge to the other side. And he's like, and I've been there ever since. And so now I just try to help people. So, it was obviously a little lengthier than that. But I mean, I thought it's like, why don't more people think like that?
Why are no more people more guilty?
Well, yeah. Why isn't the guilt factor there? I mean, come on. Just like, you've helped create this. Now come over and help, you know, help people out that you've basically have ruined their lives in many ways because of your bad pain management practices.
So the negative emotions of guilt had positive outcomes.
I would say yes. And I'm not going to shy away from that.
Yeah.
I can't help it. I'm Middle Eastern. We have like large internal guilt all the time. So, and my family's Catholic. So there you go.
Oh yeah. And so, but you know, I think there's the whole, like, every kind of community I feel like has this high levels of guilt.
Yeah.
Involved in them.
I mean, there's bad guilt too, but you know, I thought it was an interesting way when people are like, well, it's already done. We can't do anything. Well, you actually can. You can actually help. So, you know, that can be said about a lot of people who like to complain about things. There are ways to help. So,
well, and I think that's a lot of things. I think a lot of people want to sit down and complain about problems, but they don't really want to sit down and solve the problems. And solve the problems that are going to be compromising. And it's going to be things that, you know, we're going to have to do stuff that you're not necessarily too thrilled about.
Compromising is not a thing these days. I mean, it's not as widely used as it used to be. I feel like people don't want to compromise. They want to be angry and complain. And, you know, I mean.
Well, there's no longer the Ted Kennedys and Bob Doles in, you know, Senate and Congress. So.
Yeah, there's some very different people in Senate and Congress these days. But, you know, enough about that. Where the heck have you been, though? Because you weren't here either last month.
Yeah, we both abandoned ship. We both went to the National Harm Reduction Conference, which for some insane reason, they said, let's do it in New Orleans because no one will ditch out of their talks if we're in New Orleans in the French Quarter during the conference.
Just put us in the belly of the beast. And
so,
like,
you can tell I attended every single session.
Oh, absolutely.
Because I did
too.
Not go and get raw oysters and shrimp like every chance I got.
Right.
I did not. You know, the one thing I do have to say about New Orleans is everything comes in the plastic cups. And just being a Seattle kid all the time, walking down the street with a tequila.
Yeah.
As I saw the police, I just naturally tried to put it in my pocket.
Yeah, I did that too.
And the cop was like, it's fine.
Tourist.
And I was like, oh, yeah.
So, or when you're standing at a bar and they're like, do you want this for here or to go? And you're like, I don't even know how to answer that. Okay, to go. Yeah. I want it for both. I want one for here and one to go for later, you know? So, yeah, they had us in the French Quarter in New Orleans for a harm reduction conference.
I was talking to a colleague who said, having a drink while watching the talks was a much more enjoyable experience.
Right. Harm reduction for my brain.
Yeah. On a serious note, though, I was able to do a series of talks that I was really excited about, and it was really around stimulant use. And I feel like, you know, stimulant use in the Northwest was kind of bigger in the 90s, and it's definitely have come back, but I think it's really important that it never went away, you know. And we did kind of a history of stimulant services, really talking about in like 93, you know, when I was still in high school,
sure.
We had people like Mark Kinsley handing out crack pipes in New England. You know, and we had Paul Harkin giving out meth and crack pipes in Florida, of all places.
Oh, Florida.
You know, and we had Mona Bennett really helping folks, you know, in Atlanta. And really this idea that, like, these services that now PRA proudly does we didn't really invent any of these services.
They already existed.
They already existed, and we already did these really great projects throughout the country. And I think, you know, it's this place where I feel like we sometimes forget our history. And, you know, I think activism does this a lot, is they play this reinvention of the wheel every generation. You know, you kind of see that from the WTO to the, you know, Occupy movement. You have people who, you know, constantly reinvent the wheel, and they forget that all these stuff has, like, you know, happened before.
Well, history repeats itself over and over. You know, I mean,
we're in the same city that had the general strike, and people seem to forget that.
Yeah,
we're the same city that shut down Christmas during the WTO.
That is the year I moved here, in fact. So that was my first Seattle experience, was that.
Okay. But, you know, a lot of these stuff, these aren't like, we constantly pretend like we reinvent the wheel, but we don't. Like, a lot of these services have existed for a long time. And, like, you know, those kind of Haight-Ashbury-like clinics, like, we had one in the University District.
Yeah.
You know? And it, the open door clinic.
There's a lot of services up here.
Yeah. You know? I mean, you know, and we forget that like in the 80s, a lot of these services closed down. In the 90s, a lot of these services got reopened. And so, you know, it was really amazing to listen to all of these great kind of almost kind of my own heroes talk about all these services that they did before. I was also able to talk around services that exist today, you know, about all these interventions that people have been doing all throughout the country that unfortunately aren't standardized, you know, and it's very hit or miss. Some places like Seattle are very lucky. We can get pipes here. And, you know, for the listeners who don't know, the main reason we hand out pipes is for reduction in disease prevention, because if you're smoking instead of injecting, you have less risk and you're also getting less of the drug.
Yeah.
And so it can be very helpful, and it means you can make your doctor's appointments. You can make these appointments.
Well, and you can access all kinds of services once you get here too. You know, like once you're here, I mean, if you're not going to come to the needle exchange if you're a stimulant user and we don't have any services, you know, for you. You don't have pipes. We don't have this or that. You're not going to, you would never even really come here, you know, like you might come with a friend or whatever, but then, you know, if there are services for you here, you can be like, oh, well, there's other stuff I can use here. You know, there's linkage to like Hep C. If I have Hep C, you know, I can go and get care for that. There's, you know, there's food, there's whatever. So, I mean, I think it's like, you can access a bunch of different stuff once you get here, and it's just, you know, wouldn't be people that we would see otherwise. So I think it's also that, you know.
Yeah, and it was interesting talking to some folks who were trying to do medical-assisted treatment for stimulant users.
Sure.
You know, doctors that were prescribing different forms of stimulants to try to kind of get them on a steady supply and then slowly reduce their it. And also, it was interesting learning around, like, how using antidepressants, you know, a month before you're considering quitting as a stimulant user can be very beneficial. Because once you stop, you know, you get that depression does hit.
Sure, sure. I mean, that was, I went to like a stimulant training thing not that long ago. And yeah, there was a lot of talk about like Ritalin specifically being like a thing in Europe that, you know, a lot of people are trying just for treatment options for like people who use stimulants. So I don't know a lot about that, but it makes sense. It's kind of like, you know, I think it's that whole ethos of, it's not like the drug that's the problem. It's how like it's used. Because, you know, if you're going to like do something, if you're going to do a stimulant, for instance, and you go into your doctor and you get a stimulant for whatever, there's instructions on the side. You know how much is in there. You know exactly how you're going to feel when you take this much, how you're going to feel if you double it up. But if you just go on the street and get something, you don't know how much. You don't know what's in it. You don't know if it's just this or just that. So, like, you know, you're like, okay, I guess I'll try this much and see what happens, you know?
And for folks who don't know what the hell we're talking about, where, you know, the drugs that we're mainly talking about are cocaine and methamphetamine, but there are other derivatives of stimulants. And so those are the primary drugs. And, you know, more people are using stimulants now than are using opiates in our town.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, we have some serious issues with that locally. We have PCP in the methamphetamine right now, which means you're having much more mental health crises happening on the streets. And these are something that I think someone who's not even in the drug world can start seeing more and more in our city, folks with mental health issues. And a lot of this is, you know, just stuff that's cut with.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the amount of methamphetamines that's in cocaine too. Like, you're like, I'm expecting to like do this, and then maybe in an hour or two, you know, I'm gonna come down or eat or sleep, and then you are like, oh my gosh, it's been 10 hours. Like, why am I still, you know? So I think it's that it's always that, you know, like if you were getting what you thought you were getting, you could plan accordingly. You would know how it affected you. You would be able to make decisions like concerning that. And once you get something that you don't know what it is and it affects you completely differently, I think those are the times where, you know, and even then, like, then you really don't know what's going on because you're like, I know how this affects me. Now I'm worried. Then you start getting anxiety about that because you're like, why am I still up? Why, you know, so, or, you know, if it's PCP, why am I like seeing these things? Like, what's going on? You know, so feeling different than you normally would. And then that causing anxiety, which doesn't help. And then you're not sleeping. And so, I mean, it can just getting something you don't expect to get can just turn into this whole, you know, mental breakdown anyway, you know, coupled with not sleeping and like these sorts of things. So I think it's, you know, it's just, it is interesting. It's like, if you have something that you know what it is and you're like, I know if I take this much, I'm not going to be like overamped, but if I take a little more, I'm going to be good. But if I take this much, I'm going to be like way too far, and having a guide there, then you can make, you know, you're going to make whatever decision that, you know, wherever you want to be on that, you know, pole. Like if you want to be more going overamped, if you want to be kind of higher, if you just want to be like normal, I mean, you can make those decisions because you have a guide.
Yeah. I mean, it's not unlike, you know, people not drinking caffeine late at night.
Right.
Because caffeine's a stimulant.
Yeah.
You know,
but you're also like, I know how strong I can make my cup of coffee. There's directions on the back of the coffee, like 2 spoonfuls in your thing. You know what that tastes like. So if you want a little more, you do more. If you want a little less, you do less. And you know when to take it. So, I mean, it you know, because it's got guidelines. It's got, you know, and you do it enough that you know. But also, you're not getting coffee that accidentally has cocaine in it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where you're like, oh, I thought that was just coffee. But nope, it wasn't. You know, so it's, you know, it's all about like, I don't know. There's something to be said about like having actual instructions and knowing what's in drugs, you know,
yeah,
of any kind. And when I say drugs, I just want to be clear. I'm speaking about, you know, drugs that may or may not be illegal, and also prescription drugs and anything else, you know. So I'm not just referring to like one type of, you know, drug. So, yeah, I think, you know, I don't know. It's so, yeah, I think it's interesting. It's like there has been a lot more like sleep deprivation is the big thing I see. There used to be not as much sleep deprivation. You know, I think people are just like, and I think it's scarier too on the streets, especially. You've got a lot of like just people coming out of their neighborhoods and like beating people up and just being very violent towards folks. And I think that can be scary as well.
I mean, I definitely think this city has, you know, someone who's from the city, I feel like we've definitely have a big city problems, you know, in a way that I don't think we've had for a really long time. Because, you know, the joke about Seattle used to be it's the biggest small town in the country.
The most livable city.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, like there was a time, you know, in my parents' generation where, you know, restaurants closed at 6 p.m.
What was the thing like turn the lights off when last person out of Seattle turn the lights off? Yeah. Because my dad lived here at that time, I mean, like in the 70s, you know. Oh, how different it is now. But I mean, I really think there's also a social issue with a lot of the people who, and a lot of the new people who are moving here, just like not even trying to understand what's going on in the city. They just get here, they pay a bunch of money, and they're like, I don't want to see this. I don't want these people. And then some people will get amped up about it and go out and hurt people. You know,
I mean, Belltown's a great example. People constantly complaining about poor people living there. I was like, the poor people were already there.
Yeah.
Right. Like you moved into their neighborhood.
Like, do you know what Belltown used to look like?
Yeah. I mean, like East Downtown, you like used to be a condemned building and some teriyaki shops. Right.
And everyone hanging out. I mean, that was like the thing. So, you know, but yeah, just pulling back to the stimulants. I mean, I think people nowadays use it in tandem with opioids all the time. You know, like it's a defense mechanism, especially when you're on the streets, because you're like, I want to stay up because I don't want to sleep at night because bad things are going to happen to me, or people, you know, are going to like mess with me. And I think especially for women, too, that can be a thing. And specifically in the U District, there's a lot of, you know, college dudes and bros coming out and like messing with women who are experiencing homelessness on the streets. And so a lot of women will just stay up all night. They yeah. won't sleep.
Do you know what the most dangerous thing you can do on the streets is? Sleep.
Yeah, exactly.
Is the most dangerous thing you can do. It is the time that you're the most vulnerable.
Sure. And you can't defend yourself.
You know, there's a reason why, you know, if you notice, you'll see a lot of homeless women kind of congregating together, mm-hmm. right? And like sitting on a stoop together.
Yeah.
Because it's safer in numbers.
Yeah, well, right? Absolutely.
And, you know, you add young men really drunk, mm-hmm. first time out of their family's house, acting a little mob mentality, mm-hmm. Does not help the safety for it, you know. And so you end up getting a lot of trauma, and then trauma breeds addiction, mm-hmm. right? And so I think if we want to make a better Seattle, I think the conversation we really need to happen is how do we have less trauma in our city?
But how do we have less hostility towards, you know, people who are vulnerable, people who are, you know, experiencing homelessness, people who are, you know, all kinds of basically vulnerable, all kinds of people who are vulnerable. Like, I feel like if you're vulnerable in this city and you're trying to access a service, you know, there's some online page or some person harassing you somewhere, you know, they're talking about you, they're taking pictures of you, they're harassing you. So I think, you know, it's why do people feel the need to do that, to attack people who are already really vulnerable and just experiencing a lot of trauma? Why do they do that?
Well,
and you know, how can we bring them over to help? You know, I mean, that's the thing. If you have a complaint, let's get a solution together. Let's come over and help then.
Well, and I think it's there, that bigotry of all of those people.
Well, yeah, you know, the separation, sure.
You know, I'm thinking of Rick, the owner of Big Time Brewery. And I've had many conversations with him. He, you know, he's a guy who has a lot of strong opinions. But the one thing that I've always been really, you know, felt that he's really gotten it is, you know, he's happy to hire homeless people. You know,
he's great.
You know, he's happy to engage people, and he wants to work with the people who want to make a better neighborhood and a better community. You know, one of his little secrets that I'm sure he's going to yell at me for.
It's not a secret if you say it on the radio. Yeah, I just want to like tell you that right
yeah,
now.
Yeah. So one of his little things that he likes to do, which I think is great, is he'll go up to a group of homeless folks and say, "Hey, I'll pay everyone, you know, $20 for the next hour who wants to help me clean my back alley."
Yeah.
And, you know, the ones who are really hardworking, really going for it, you know, that's really his job interview to see if for his next dishwasher.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you're willing to, you know, sweep the streets, you know, hard, then you're willing to wash dishes and you're willing to do this. And, you know, he takes care of his kitchen staff, and he really tries his hardest to, you know, give people opportunities. You know, once he's given the opportunity, you got to take that opportunity.
Yeah.
Right. And totally. For me, it's like that, you know, it's that piece of that old Seattle where, mm-hmm. you know, if you got that shot, you fucking took it. And that small business like, oh, took it. And so you made your opportunity. You made your better life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think, and I also think like, I mean, we were talking about this, a couple friends and me last night, about, you know, other countries and like homelessness. And I was talking about Tokyo and like how I was like, I have not seen a person on the streets here since I've been here, you know? And my friend was just like, yeah, because we take care of our people. Why would we let people sleep on the streets? That's awful. Like, that's not what people, they're like, why do you all let people sleep on the streets? I'm like, it's just so complicated. And they're like, well, everything's complicated apparently in your country. Like, yeah, in a lot of ways it is, but you know, that's the thing about democracies and capitalism, it's all very complicated. But you know, I mean, they were just like, why would we let why would we let our people sleep on the streets? That's insane. Like, you know, so I think it's just a cultural thing. Maybe that is our culture. People say we don't have a culture here, but.
Well, one of the things I think, you know, that I appreciate, like when I was in Paris, and there's a police station right near the front of the Eiffel Tower, mm-hmm. right? And there at night, there's a whole bunch of homeless people who sleep in front of that police station.
Yeah, there's a big park right there.
Yeah, and it's the police who request them to sleep there because they want to make sure they're safe. They're not going to be taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. No one's going to get hurt. No one's going to get sexually assaulted because the police are right there, right? And, you know, I think it's just a different mentality of, you know, we need to keep vulnerable citizens protected.
Right.
And, you know, I do get a little touchy-feely sometimes because I feel like, you know, if we need to love people, we need to engage people. And we also need, for me, again, it's like the ones who want to be good neighbors and the ones who want to be positive influences in our community, we need to engage more and, you know, we need to make it the easiest path of, you know, getting off the streets and building a better life is being much more neighborhood conscious and being much more, you know, a member of the community. I remember when I was homeless going and getting Italian sodas at Allegro Cafe and just sitting there and drawing,
yeah.
you know, and getting, you know, some of my first jobs were working in the U District. Were folks who just, you know, saw me around and started talking to me. And, you know, I just grabbed my opportunities. And, you know, like there are definitely folks who have mental illness and some other trauma that we probably need to support in different ways.
Sure.
But I think there's a lot of folks that really do want the opportunity. I talk to folks all the time who, you know, do odd jobs for the small businesses
here.
Oh,
yeah, there's plenty of that. And I do appreciate that about this neighborhood specifically because I don't see that in my neighborhood of White Center. I don't see that. I don't see that downtown. I mean, I see that here. And I also think that's kind of there. If there's somewhere in this city where that old Seattle vibe still exists, I do feel like it's this neighborhood, not only because of the aesthetic, which is changing very quickly, but you can still kind of recognize it, you know, as okay, you know, you drive downtown, you can't recognize anything from back then. But I mean, I do feel like that old vibe kind of still exists up here. Hopefully it'll keep going. I don't know for how long, but you know, I think also being part of a community, yes, but when the community is now very hostile to people in most other neighborhoods, and I have seen it in this neighborhood, it, you know, it separates people. That gap grows, you know. You're like, okay, well, you want to... I had a mom say to me today that she called on the phone, and she was, like, just frustrated because she was like, you know, my son is up there, and I, you know, I don't live anywhere near, but she's like, I'm just so mad because he's not allowed to exist. Like, he can't sit anywhere. He can't stand anywhere. He can't sleep anywhere. He can't look at anything. He's, like, constantly, you know, and she's like, they move him here. They move him there. They move him over there. You know, like, is he allowed to exist as a person in this world? And I'm like, you know, we call that, like, the crime of existing in a space. You know, I mean, it's a very real thing where you are literally not welcome anywhere at all.
Well, they tell you where you can't be, but they never tell you where you can be.
Because you can't be anywhere. I mean, that's the right thing. You don't have anywhere to be. So we want to get rid of all the places where people can be, but we're not making a clear path for people. You're right. We're not making a clear path to housing, number one. It's not even clear to the people who work in that realm how to do that, you know? Yeah. So I think it's like, and that's the other thing is like, no one would be able to navigate these systems without help.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the real crime right there. Like if you can't go in and navigate how to get housing by yourself, you have to get this person and a case manager and this other person. You have to go to this building and that building and across town and over here. And how are you going to get there? We don't know because the buses aren't free downtown anymore. And you can't get any public transit anywhere. So, you know, figure it out. try to get on the light rail and not get caught. I don't know. You know, so it's like there's never these like, I mean, there's so many tiny things.
I think with all of that said, I still think there are really great people in Seattle who are really trying to do their very best and really doing what they can. You know, and I think this is kind of that season where people start caring about poor people.
We'll get some volunteers and all the services for about 3 months, and then once they renew their January gym membership, they'll all disappear again.
Oh yeah. You know, and I do, you know, I have noticed though that a really demographic in our volunteers are very low income folks. Sure. And then there's very privileged folks. And the middle, it's getting harder and harder to live. I mean, you know,
you don't have extra time to volunteer because you have to work all the time.
I mean, what is it? $1,600 for a one bedroom apartment in this town now. And so, you know, you have to, you know, and so if you have to make double that in order to even live.
Nobody's living in their own apartment anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's like, you know how the baby boomers used to dream about buying a house someday. People now are just dreaming about living by themselves when they're 37. Not that that's specific to me, but it is. So, you know, the dreams have changed.
Yeah.
But, you know, I did want to ask you something, though. You've been writing articles lately.
Yeah. I have been writing articles.
Would you like to talk about that?
Sure. I did one on stimulants, which we've talked about.
Yeah.
And I did one. I was lucky enough to be invited to tour a couple, you know, shooting galleries, safe consumption rooms. I think, you know, we really need to, you know, in this conversation, I think we need to think about them in various ways. You know, the way I started touring these places, what I noticed was that they were a little more organized than, let's say, when I was younger and using in some of these places.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these places have Narcan. A lot of these places have someone who's kind of overseeing and making sure everyone's safe, you know. And so now, you know, I think we need to redefine these safe places. Mm-hmm. What we can agree, what is not a safe place is like a McDonald's bathroom where it's a single stall and or a single room and you
definitely
lock the door behind you,
place.
You know. But if you, I mean, think of this. So if you're in an encampment, right? Let's say you're in this little green belt on the side of the freeway,
mm-hmm.
right? And let's say there's 5 tents,
mm-hmm.
right? And you and your friends happen to use drugs there. And if there's someone who is being there, the responsible one, at depending on the times, are there to make sure everyone's safe, has Narcan, has been trained, is that a safe consumption space, right? It is probably safe because you're probably not going to die there.
Right.
Right?
Well, people die when they're alone, when they're hiding.
And so is that a safe consumption space? And so what are the, like, you know, for me, I said reasonable expectations,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so in these places, there now, we could really start arguing that there's dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of them in this city. So, you know, if someone goes over to their friend's apartment and their friend's apartment is a safe place for them to get high, and there's, let's say there's 20 people, you know, in a week who come and go in who are using there, and the person always has Narcan, always has someone kind of making sure everyone's safe, cleaning up to make sure everything's in biohazard and there's a clean space. Is that not a safe consumption space?
I mean, I think that, I think the term can be really broad. And, you know, and my question really, I think, to people is, if somebody you know is using, or your child or your parent or whoever, and they come to you and say, hey, I'm going to use regardless, but I would like not to be alone. Can you come and keep an eye on me or be with me and have this Narcan or whatever? Are you going to say no?
Yeah. And you think, you know, I mean, you know, you do deliveries through our exchange program. I've done deliveries for years through our exchange program. And so we have both delivered to places that fits this description, not just once in a while, but probably most days we deliver.
Yeah, very true. Definitely have experienced lots of these places. And my personal opinion is I think they're great because it is a safe place for people to be. and have people around them where they feel comfortable. The thing is they feel comfortable that someone's going to be there if they happen to, you know, stop breathing or something happens. And also, they're not going to do as much damage to themselves when they are injecting because they don't have to hurry. You know, they're not in like a public bathroom or somewhere, so they can like take their time. You know, they can like tie off right. They can inject properly. So they're not missing. They're not getting abscesses. And it can be really beneficial in lots of different ways.
Well, I mean, I can tell you that this was many months ago, and I was doing a delivery run, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there was someone, when I was delivering, there was someone who was smoking cocaine,
mm-hmm.
right? So they're smoking crack. And I saw something that was like really like beautiful in the sense that they kept kind of like, you know, kept taking a hit. And the person there was like, hey, you know, why don't you try some oxygen with that? Right. You know, and like, why don't we take a break? Why don't we take a deep breath, you know, between hits? And I thought about that and I was like, right there, that person did a harm reduction, any positive change approach to that
sure.
person.
Yeah.
If that person was alone, that person would have just kept using and using and using. But that person, there was someone there to say, hey, I care about you. I'm just, you know, why don't we take some oxygen in before we take mm-hmm. the next hit? And those are like positive health steps. You know, these are things that would exist in a safe and things that do exist in European and Canadian
yeah.
safe consumption spaces. And so to say that, you know, we don't have them, we have thousands and thousands throughout this country.
Well, and what about active bathrooms? Just saying.
Yeah, I mean, bathrooms that are being used in facilities right now. And so I think, you know, the reason I wrote this article for me had less to do with me talking about how all these kind of shooting galleries or drug user safe spaces existed, but more to talk about how they have started to have different policies and they're starting mm-hmm. to create their own policies and procedures
sure.
and they're starting to create their own rules, right? And, you know, if as we talk about creating, you know, kind of state-run ones or nonprofit-run ones,
mm-hmm.
then, you know, we have to be careful to make sure that all of them are very user-friendly.
Well, I was going to say, if you open some big, crazy, fancy, you know, safe injection site or consumption room and no one comes, like, you know, I mean,
I agree.
What's the point,
well,
you know?
And also, you know, something that I thought was really interesting, you know, most people don't realize that we have a statute in the state that says you can't have a marijuana club, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the biggest complaints from tourists are they can smell marijuana that homeless people are smoking in the Pike Place Market. Right.
And they're just jealous because they don't know where to get it and they can't. Is that?
And so one of the things I've been thinking more and more is like, you know, we can have lots of different kinds of consumption spaces,
mm-hmm.
you know, a place where someone could be a little container where someone could smoke marijuana. Right. In a kind of a safe space. You know, you're not going to get ticketed. You're not going to
because that's the thing about being homeless and like smoking marijuana, like you're not supposed to smoke it in public, but like you don't have a house. So
yeah.
Where exactly are you supposed to smoke it? So only privileged people get to smoke marijuana now? I mean,
and to be perfectly honest, bars are safe consumption spaces because everything they serve is not going to be tainted. You're not going to go blind by getting the red hook.
You know what you're getting, exactly.
You know? And they're regulated.
As I was saying before, you know what you're getting. You know how drunk it's going to make you. You know how much you need.
Well, and as a bartender, because I have a bartender's license.
As do I, yes.
If I overserve someone and they die, that's on me.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think, you know, over time, you know, these consumption spaces really are talking about this.
Mm.
And these, like, drug users and these activists are having these conversations. You know, to be perfectly honest, I feel more afraid for them than I feel for, you know, because, you know, almost everything we do is above board.
Mm-hmm.
We are very much, you know, trying to do great work. But these folks don't have lawyers. They don't have a board. They don't have a 501c3 structure. They don't, they're doing it
because it needs to be done. It's the right thing to do. That's why they're doing it.
Yeah. And
it has to be done.
And they're doing it to make sure people are safe. And if one of these places get busted, they are going to be in a lot of trouble. And I really fear for them and their safety, even though they're doing the job that people have, to be very honest, haven't done, and we have failed as a community to not do, because people are dying.
Well, yeah.
And you know, we can talk all the morality we want, but like, you know, I don't want any more dead citizens. I, you know, we talked about trauma earlier. You know, think of the trauma of the mom whose son or daughter died of a heroin overdose.
I don't even have to think about it. You know, like I see and talk to the moms and people who have lost, you know, husbands, and people have lost wives, people have lost brothers. I mean, that is, unfortunately, these days, that is like a normal thing. Somebody in your family or someone close to you died of an overdose, you know? And I think you're right. It's like there has been a change kind of in the underground scene with like, okay, well, obviously our community who has said they're going to do, you know, these consumption rooms isn't, because, you know, we just continue to push it off and push it off and push it off. You know, and these are people being directly affected. So, of course, they're not going to just sit around and watch their friends die. They're going to do something. And they have.
I mean, you've been to, I've delivered to places where, like, you're actually at, people are living with their parents, and their parents are, you know, have Narcan, been trained.
100%. And, all the time.
And want, don't want their kids to die, right?
And they always have questions like, oh, I don't know if... And I'm like, hey, you know what? Actually, like, you're being an amazing parent right now. Like, you... I mean, yeah. This is unconditional love. You love your child. You want them not to die. You want to help them make healthy decisions. Like...
Yeah, and I mean, know? You know how many people, how many parents take their kids to the Suboxone clinic?
So many.
Here... And how many people are like, you know, and, you know, we're getting back to this, the treatment side of this. Like, we are, all the Suboxone clinics are overrun. And, you know, it's hard, you know, getting harder and harder to get people.
Waiting list.
And, you know, sure. And we need more. And so we need primary care doctors. Again, you guys caused this problem. It's time for you guys to treat this problem.
So, like, shout out to primary care doctors. Hep C treatment and Suboxone.
Yeah.
These are the two things you can do immediately.
Well, and if you think about it, this, if every primary care doctor started, was able to treat, we wouldn't need these standalone Suboxone places, right? Because you could just go to a doctor and see a doctor, you know, and I think...
Well, and then, you know, there's a cap on how many people you can treat too. So then there's that.
Yeah, but
well,
if every doctor, you could go to any primary care doctor, you know, there, everyone could have 30 patients that were on Suboxone, you know, because everyone, you know, would be, you know, at different clinics.
Yeah, that's true. Well, and they wouldn't have to travel halfway across the sound on ferries and whatever else to, you know, get, whether it's Suboxone or methadone or whatever. I mean, there's so few services that's what people end up doing. They end up traveling all over the place to get services.
Well, and you think about all of the people who are, were homeless in the U District right now, who have engaged our Suboxone clinic and are now housed. And, you know, these are folks that I've known. I've worked at the Exchange for 22 years.
Yeah.
And these are people I've known for 15, 10 years of this program. And then, you know, there's this moment that I see in their eyes, and I see so much hope, and I see so much love in their eyes. And this sounds really simple, but, like, you know, I had one of our participants who I've worked with for 15 years, had been homeless, always been in a chaotic place. He offered to buy me lunch the other day, right? And he's the person who's been, like, always begging me for my leftovers, always begging me for my extra food for years. And, you know, I've always tried to feed him when I could. But he wants, you know, he wanted to take me out to food. And, you know, there's something that I just felt, you know, that I just felt that amount of love that he cared enough, you know, and that he was stable enough that he had the opportunity to do that. You know, and it was, you know, I feel like those are the moments that I feel like, why can't we do more of this?
Right.
You know,
why can't that be the norm?
Yeah. And there's so many people who really desire help and really, you know, just need access to it. Let's make this as low as physical barriers as possible.
Right.
Let's make the easy choice getting services. You know, I mean, there was a person in King County who said this best. Mm-hmm. Who remain nameless.
I think I know who you're going to talk about here.
We need to be in direct competition with drug dealers.
Oh, absolutely.
We need to make treatment as easy to get as buying a bag on the street.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, are you going to, that is the thing. Cause it's like, are you going to go and get on a waiting list for 6 days from now? You can go in and then you've got to, like, you know, jump through all these hoops once you're inside the program. You know, or are you going to go down the street and just, like, find your dude and be like, all right, cool, I'm going to buy a bag.
Yeah.
Way easier.
And there's so many people I meet, like, early in the morning who will come up to me and say, Shiloh, please, can I get in today? And, yep. You know, I'll put, well, you know.
My phone rings at least 30 times a day with that question. Can I squeeze in today? Can I get fit?
Well, and and our Suboxone doctor, who's a nurse practitioner, she's amazing. It was Bob Quinn's best friend, Fern, a rabbi. And she tries to make every second that she's here count to make sure people can have access. And, you know, like, we could have her easily work here 20 hours a day.
We don't want to turn her into us. Yeah. Like, let's not do that. That's not healthy for anyone.
Well, she's much more healthy, so.
This is very true.
So, all that said, you know, I think for me, if anyone's listening, and I do mean, is anyone listening?
Are you out there? Hello.
If you could do me a favor for this season, is if you could call your legislature and really demand proper science-based treatments for folks so we can get more Suboxone clinics, we can get more syringe access, we can get safe consumption spaces to combat the opiate crisis. Because the CDC, when I was at the Harm Reduction Conference, said that they thought it was going to raise to, 100,000 people in 2019.
Yeah, for this year the projection is 80,000.
Yeah, and they thought it was going
to
jump
to die of overdose.
Yeah. They thought it was going to jump at 20,000 next year.
If it were anything else, that would be a call to a movement. You know, people would be very upset. So I feel like,
yeah, and these are people's kids. These are people's loved ones, and these are people who just need access to proper care. And they need proper mental health care. And if you could do one thing this season, I really hope that you could just call your elected officials and say that you really support these projects and you want to see more of them in this city.
If you want to do two things, you could also donate to us at the People's Harm Reduction Alliance. We could certainly use the help. Gonna throw that out there.
Oh yeah. And if you're just flooding with money, I know this great radio station that could use a couple of bucks too. If you're thinking about donating a cool $1 million to a starving radio station, you know, that were kind enough to put a couple crazies on the radio, KODX 96.9 could really use your donations. along with the People's Harm Reduction Alliance.org is our website to do the donations. And if you ever want to volunteer, we would love to have you. We're looking for really compassionate, loving people who care about their community.
And I guess that's us. That about wraps up the show. So basically, be nice to people and donate to nonprofits and help out. Love y'all.
Love you.